board workshop to order. And do we need to do all the protocol and everything again this time?
Yeah, we should.
Okay.
Yeah, we do have speakers.
Would you please then, Ms. Schultz, read our protocol for the meeting?
Okay. Welcome to the meeting of the San Dieguito Union High School District Board of Trustees. If you wish to speak to an item on the agenda, please complete a speaker slip located at the sign-in desk and present it to the secretary to the board prior to the start of the meeting. When the board president invites you to the podium, please state your name before making your presentations. That doesn't apply. In the interest of time and order, presentations from the public are limited to 3 minutes per person per topic. The total time for agenda and agenda items shall not exceed 20 minutes. An individual speaker's allotted time may not be increased by a donation of time from others in attendance. In accordance with the Brown Act, unless placed on the published agenda, no action shall be taken by the board on non-agenda items. However, the board may acknowledge receipt of the information, refer the matter to staff for further study, or refer the matter to a future agenda. In compliance with Government Code Section 54957.5, agenda-related documents that have been distributed to the board less than 72 hours prior to the board meeting have been available for review on the district website or at the district office. No consent. As a courtesy to all meeting attendees, please set cell phones and electronic devices to silent mode and engage in conversations outside the meeting room. Thank you.
All right. So this afternoon, at this point, it brings us directly to our public comment section. And as Ms. Schultz said, it's the three-minute clock will be running. And I would like to remind folks, if it rings, you hit the 3 minute mark, to please wrap it up. You know, take a sentence, finish it up. But we need to try and maintain the 3 minute limit equally. So the first one here is a Nancy. Is it Sepley?
Sepley.
Thank you. Would you please step up near the podium and. Thank you.
So does my time start now?
Yep.
She'll run off okay. For you.
Thank you. I've never presented at the board meeting before. I'm Nancy Seafley. I have a junior at LCC, and I have a sixth grader who's going to be going into Degaño. And I'm here to, first off, offer my kudos and praise for Mr. Golden at LCC. He has done an absolutely outstanding job of taking a theater program that really needed a tremendous amount of work, and he's building it and making it stronger. And I, only as a parent going to see the theater shows, have been able to see the changes. My son, who's a junior, is not involved in theater. I'm a soccer mom, but now I'm also a theater mom. My younger son is very much in love with the arts and has done theater. I had the pleasure of going to see the recent production at LCC called Les Mis, and I was absolutely blown away with the talent and the production. When I inquired about who was involved and learned they did not have a technician, I almost passed out. There is so much work involved in theater, and my son's done community theater. They don't have it at elementary, and they don't have it at Degaño, as far as I know, just a little program. But to do it at this scale takes a lot of work, and I have, as a parent, volunteered and done this. So I asked around, I've talked to some parents, and I care because my son's coming up the chain. He'll be going to Degaño, and I want him to go to LCC and be in theater. I live by LCC. I don't want to drive him to San Dieguito, and I don't want to have to drive him to CCA because their programs are better. So what I've learned is there is a disparity. It seems unfair to me that they have technicians at all three schools, San Dieguito Academy, Canyon Crest, and Torrey Pines. Why not at LCC? I don't understand. I've asked parents who have students that go there, and it's my understanding informally that they do have a role, a person who is paid and does that for those programs. So, and you probably already know, but in case you don't, a theater production person really does a ton in the background. Lighting, sound, safety, all this stuff. And guess who's doing it at LCC? It's parent volunteers and students, and I'm here to tell you, I'm volunteer of the year at Encinitas Union School District for Mission Estancia. I volunteer a lot, and I am tapped out. I don't know how much more I can give, and I love it, and I will do it, but you're asking the parents and the students to do too much, and the students are the ones doing this, and they need to be studying. My son has 5 AP classes, and if my younger son hopefully can go on that same track, he's not going to have time to help with theater, and I'm going to have to say no because there's too much work involved. They're pulling on the students. They're pulling on the parents. We love to help, but we need somebody professionally to support this program, and I really believe you should strongly consider adding. I don't know how it works. I've not done this before, how you get people employed and to work at the school, but I really advise you strongly consider it because it's a really important role, and I'm seeing the arts inequality at LCC. So thank you for your time. Right.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to come and speak with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Wendy Gump is our other speaker slip.
Yeah, what does that say?
It's not fast, so I don't
know. Hello. My name is Wendy Gum. I'm a parent in the district. You all are probably tired of seeing me. But my son is graduating, so that should give you some hope, but probably not. So getting to the board workshop for the budget. So I just have some questions. According to the workshop budget, we're clearly not getting back to basic aid before 2021, so I hope we're going to talk about that a little bit so we stop wishing and hoping for basic aid. There's a pretty big gap, so I hope that we're going to talk a little bit deeper about what's in the gap, what the gap consists of, and how we're magically going to close it, because it seems like that's what's been said for the last 18 months, is every time we have a budget and we have this big deficit, we magically close the gap, and clearly we are not magically closing it anymore. The question is how do you plan to fill the gap? What does the gap include? What items make up the deficit spending being proposed? And then, of course, I'm going to go on to what I always go on to, is how is the foundation money accounted for in the deficit spending plan? Last year, the four high school foundations, collected almost $5 million, and only $600,000 was recognized as being donated to the school. And as Ms. Shipley said, there's a lot of pressure already put on parents in our community to give to our schools and our foundations. And with this huge spending deficit that we have this year, to ask for more money from the parents when you're clearly not showing how the donations are being recognized to fill those gaps in the district is a huge issue. We really want to show the money the foundations is spending on programs and services year over year. We want to know where the money is going, how it's being spent, and how it's publicly being allocated to bridge the gap. Further, the district needs to really consider conducting a forensic audit of the foundations to ensure that the money they are asking parents for in the name of the school to fill the very large gap that is actually, the district is actually saying is actually getting to the district to fill that gap. The public does not believe the money the foundation says it is raising for school-connected programs is actually for school-sponsored programs. Now our students are being told their programs might be cut. What are the programs in the gap at every site, and what is needed to protect the integrity of those programs? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And that brings us to our...
I think many of the things that we've heard today will be addressed as Ms. Douglas and Mrs. Perley go through their presentation. So I think at this point I'd like to turn it over to them and let them get through the presentation. If we have questions along the way, we can certainly address that.
Thank you.
And I'll say while Mrs. Douglas is getting ready that, Mrs. Gum, it pleases me when every student graduates. So just for the record.
I'm pleased that he's made it.
So I'm curious, Eric, what would it take for the so we do have the foundation director here. So the foundations put their budget up every year, everything they've spent on the website?
I'm not sure exactly what each one of them is doing now. You're correct. I have not seen that at La Costa Canyon. Uh-huh. But I don't know if we want to address that. Sure, Joanne, if you want to.
We post our audited financial statements on our website.
So that every dollar that is accounted for them, like where it's going to?
Yes.
And,
yes.
Okay. Yeah, so they're each audited by their independent audit. By their independent auditors, and we do receive copies of that.
So my question is, so it's broken down by sport and everything else, or something. So if someone like in soccer knows where it's going.
And the audited financial statements are subject to the auditor's procedures and GAAP, and mm-hmm. so it would be a higher level. So you would see Athletics, Envision, Quest are higher level. And then if you wanted to see like a breakdown for girls' soccer, for example, the liaison for girls' soccer can come in and see every single check. They've requested every single check be written in the first place, so, but if they wanted to see every single check, they could.
And it could be just put that online, like just a little tree, like, okay, soccer.
I don't think I would want to be putting their check information
online.
Not their
check, but just how much the overall and where it's going, so everybody just knows we're just clear on it. It's tax dollars. There's no question.
Well, they're not tax dollars, first of all. They're donor dollars.
But donated taxpayer dollars.
They're not they're donor dollars, so it's different than a taxpayer. Taxpayer dollars.
The taxpayers
in the community
are the ones. Well,
we all are taxpayers. So
I think I will ask that we come back to our presentation to start with, and
so,
thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks. We didn't mean
response.
To put you on the spot.
But thank you. I appreciate it.
But you're more than welcome to come up and do the presentation.
Thanks for answering my questions. Appreciate it.
So this evening, we're going to be going over budget. So kind of the premise of what we're going to be sharing with you tonight. The governor's May revised budget does not actually get released until tomorrow at 10. And so what you're going to see and what Ms. Purley is going to be presenting is where we were at second interim, which included the governor's January budget proposal. And so the numbers are not any different than what they were back then because the May revise hasn't been released yet. That will be released tomorrow. We go to the governor's, and that's a state level. Then we have school services and whatnot and people that take that information and translate that down to an LEA impact. And so we're going to the governor's May revise where we'll find some of that information out on the following Friday. And so what the premise of this meeting is we'll share some of those numbers and then we'll have some budget considerations, if you will, to have conversations. And the goal of tonight's meeting is to find out a framework, if you will, on the board's priorities on what they would like to see included in our first draft of the budget at the first meeting in June when we present the draft budget at that point in time. We'll then take into consideration the things that have happened with the May revise that we know, include that in with the budget and see what we were able to do and bring back at that time. So, as you know, the LCAP is a driving force of supplemental dollars that we receive here in the district. The district does not receive much in the sense of supplemental dollars because our demographic does not have the nature of students that are subject to receiving those dollars. So we get about $2.8 million in supplemental money from the state. What that money is to be used for is to improve or increase services for students within a certain population, our low socioeconomic disadvantaged students, our foster youth kids. And those dollars now have always been should be used to decrease that gap, if you will, for those students that are low performing. And so what we do then with the dashboard, and I know that's very difficult to see, but it's just meant to kind of be a pictorial. We take the lowest performing students, we look at this dashboard, and we determine how do we use those supplemental dollars to increase the student achievement for these kids. And so what you probably can't see because it is small is there are some red pies, there's two, and so we would focus on some of those lower performing students and addressing what programs we might be able to use to improve and increase services for those particular students. The LCAP is broken down into four different goals, and you'll see each of the goals there. Our projected spending by goal is included there in the parentheses. That's what that dollar amount is. So for goal one, we actually have about $1.9 million allocated to that. Goal two, about $247,000. Goal three, $251,000, and goal four, $452,000. So this is kind of where we are in terms of LCAP. Not a lot of detail because we're still working on developing that plan. We actually have a meeting with the county office in a couple of weeks to go over kind of the first draft. But this is where, in large chunks, we spend some of those supplemental dollars to improve those services. And we'll see the first draft of the LCAP here at our first budget meeting, our first board meeting in June as well.
And I would say it's very consistent with this year's LCAP. Okay. It's just the dollar amounts are different.
So I talked a little bit about this in the sense that student achievement is where, obviously, and why we're in business. And those dollars are specifically geared for those kids and closing that gap. That model now, what we need to do is we need to be looking at how we develop the LCAP and if we are doing what we say we were going to do and are we making those strides in improving the outcomes of those students. And then looking at that and really trying to hone in on, if this isn't working, then how do we readdress those dollars that we're receiving in supplemental to be able to improve services and what other programs might we be able to do that would help get us there? This is no different than what you've already seen. Like I said, since the Governor's May revise isn't out, this is just a reiteration of what that was with fully funding, as you guys all know. And so this will be the first year, 18-19, that the LCFF is fully funded. What that means in future years is that we will be receiving COLA on those dollars as opposed to any more gap funding, so we don't have the funky formulas, if you will, anymore. Whatever the COLA is, we will receive an increase based on that cost of living adjustment. We will be receiving one-time discretionary funding. What we're hearing right now is the May revise is probably going to be pretty much the same as what the governor's budget looked like. And if there are any changes, it might be more an ongoing and less in one time, but there aren't going to be any real big surprises, I think, when we see the May revise come out tomorrow.
Yeah, so it's really, if you go back there,
yes.
the top two, you know, fully funding the LCFF, that's the ongoing dollars, and the $1.8 billion is one time. You might see some of those one times shifted into that top category, but between the two, it's going to be the same amount of money.
And then some of the other items that are listed, they were some of the initiatives that were included in the governor's budget proposal. So tomorrow we're hoping that we'll have some more guidelines on what that would actually look like and translate and in terms of kind of detail behind what some of those programs would be. Ms. Gum mentioned in the sense of, and we talk about it here a little bit on the slide, in terms of basic aid, if you recall at our second or our first interim projections, we were thinking that we might go into basic aid probably in that third year out. With the fully funding of LCFF, that actually kind of shifted the revenue sooner rather than later, and it pushed us out a little bit in terms of attaining basic aid within that three-year period. So we still believe, even with our conservative projections with property taxes, that we will probably be basic aid within the next 5 years, 4 years. But it has kind of fallen off of our multi-year projection with the full implementation of LCFF. And this kind of shows, at first interim, the 2021 year actually showed us getting towards basic aid, actually at basic aid. But like I said, with the full implementation of LCFF, it pushes us out probably another year. And I'm going to
but
have...
But I would say that,
oh,
you know,
sorry.
We're still... 97% property tax, you know,
yes.
within our local control funding formula. So we're very much like a basic aid district when you look at our funding model. It's just we haven't crested over the top of the
and
allocation.
Even when we look at our LCAP, those dollars that you had listed, that's still only like a couple percent of our budget. I mean,
correct.
We have to do all the process,
correct.
But it's
correct.
Really for not a large.
Right.
Percentage of our budget dollars.
Correct.
Absolutely. I'm going to have Ms. Perley come up and kind of talk you through some of the details of the budget.
Sure. Thank you.
As we start building the budget, build the revenues, we build the expenditure side as we build the revenue kind of at the same time. The first thing we look at is our ADA and our enrollment. We did get fairly new demographic study these have been adjusted for that. At second interim, they were adjusted a little bit, and we continue to watch that. We remain at about 96%, which it can be a little deceiving, because when you look at enrollment, that's a one-day thing. Enrollment changes every day. We look at it according to a CBEDS date, which is very early October. And then we're funded on P2. The red bar is P2. So that's our cumulative ADA throughout the year until about mid-April. And that's what we get funded on for LCFF and many other restricted programs, special ed, many other things. So that all of our funding is virtually based on ADA. So we run about 96%, which isn't 96% of every student. It's kind of cumulative effect of a one-day enrollment and overall in the ADA. And as we gain and lose students, kind of the effect of that. So this is a picture of what makes up the LCFF funding. It's a calculation. We reach a dollar amount based on our enrollment and our unduplicated count, some other factors. Those go in. We get a dollar amount in the first. We talked back in the days when we became basic aid, we talked in terms of buckets. So I still like to use that term because many of us can still picture that graphic of the buckets filling up. And the first bucket that fills up for any district is their property tax. So the LCFF funding is what it is. The first place we see the dollars come in is in the property tax. And then state aid makes up the difference. Now, in this case, you see two little bars at the top. That's both EPA, or the Education Protection Account, came into play in 2012, was extended again, and that's additional dollars that come into the district is how it was built. However, it really isn't additional dollars. What it did is it helped ease the burden at the state level, because those dollars come in, every district is guaranteed at least $200 per ADA. The dollars come in, and they reduce what the state has to pay. So our state aid is really both of those bars. The first little bit, just like the first part of our LCFF funding comes from property tax, the first little bit of our state aid comes from EPA. In the event that we became basic aid, EPA plays a little bit different role in that we're still guaranteed the $200 per ADA. So that's just something down the road. Now, these estimates are 5% in our property tax going up every year and our current estimates for enrollment. So the things that will push basic aid closer or further out are several factors, one of which will be the growth of property tax. Property tax has no bearing on our students and our ADA. It just is. It's a number that we get, and that's the first part of our LCFF funding. So if we get more property tax and less students, that doesn't change that. It changes the LCFF funding overall. So that property tax is property tax. So that's the first thing, is we estimate 5% because we've been at that or above that traditionally. In the past 5 or 6 years, we've been above 5%. So it does fluctuate a little bit, but that's a pretty conservative estimate. Doesn't sound like it, but it is, it looking back at our trends. So as property tax grows, we hit better than that last year. We hit closer to almost 6%. So as property tax grows, then that causes more of our LCFF to be achieved through property tax, puts us a little closer to basic aid. So if we had a decline in enrollment, which currently our demographics are showing a little bit of a growth in that farthest out year, if we had a decline there, then that might get us into basic aid a little further. So kind of how that, there's a lot of factors at play. It's not a real easy thing to achieve in it. And as you may remember, the first year we became basic aid in 08-09, it was not determined until June, very late June of 08-09, that we were basic aid, because you really don't know till you get, you don't know how much property tax you're getting. It's an estimate until oftentimes the last day of June. And they pay the final outcome, and that's what your property tax was for the year that you just finished and that you're working on closing. So it is a little bit of a moving target, and it does keep, you know, that's why it does keep changing, comes and goes, gets a little closer, gets a little further away, partly because of our enrollment and as we watch that and our property tax estimates. So this chart you've seen before, it is based on the second interim 17-18 budget and the out years in the second interim multi-year. Just shows you where our revenue comes from. The blue bar being both property tax and LCFF, it's our entire LCFF allocation. And then from there, the very small kind of red bar right above it is federal. And then state, there is a that purple bar that kind of fluctuates year to year. They're kind of near, it's about the only bar you can see at the top real easily. That is our local income. And then the other pieces are, in prior years, we have broken out our carryover. Until we close the books, we don't know what that is. So it's not broken out in the projected years. And then transfers is a very small sliver at the top that you can't easily see because it's transfers in from other funds. And you know, it's a little, that kind of fluctuates. We don't have a lot of that. They're for specific purposes that we do that. So that gives you an idea. This is a pie chart of the 17-18 year only. And it pictures the same thing, just kind of in a pie chart. You can see that the bulk of our revenue, which is 80% on this particular slide, on this particular year we're looking at, 80% comes from LCFF sources, which include property tax, the EPA, a little bit we talked about, and the state aid. So that's where the bulk of our money comes, most of it being unrestricted. Some of it is unrestricted, but to be used for those supplemental services that are defined in our LCAP. And very little bit of it comes in and is used for some restricted resources. So the other pieces of the pie are shown kind of in comparison, just a little bit different picture of how you look at it. So we're going to the same type of charts for expenditures. Now we're going to show those a few ways. First one being a bar chart, just showing each category of expenditure. So at the bottom, that's certificated salaries. Next one up, that kind of lime green, is classified salaries. The maybe mint green that's above that, that continues to grow, are our benefits. And our benefits would be all our labor-related costs, our unemployment, our work comp, our STIRS and PERS contributions, employer-required contributions, and health benefits. So all of those things are in there. It continues to grow, as you know, because of our state-mandated percentages that are going up in STIRS and PERS. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. The books and supplies being on top of that, very kind of, it's actually just the things. And then above that, that orange is the services and other operating expenses. That includes our utilities. It includes our non-public schools. It includes, you know, some of those big ticket items that I know that you know, and then other things. The consultant that came in and helped us, that is coming in and helping us with the special ed task force, that would be in the services and other operating expenses. So it's a variety of things of kind of outside services that we bring in when we need them, and then the utilities and other things that are kind of static. And then a few other pieces on top of that, the other outgo and capital outlay, which you can hardly see in a comparison because most of our capital outlay expenditures are not in the general fund. Those are funded through our capital funds, a good portion Prop AA, and then some of our other capital resources that we charge the bulk of those things to. So this is just general fund expenses for equipment that's over $5,000. In past years, we new servers, that kind of thing. So it's a very limited amount of capital expenditures in the general fund.
I have a question. Now, where is the administration in that? Are they within
what department? That bar chart, I'll get to that in a minute, because that bar chart is shown by the type of thing we buy. So certificated salaries, classified salaries, not by the service it provides. We do have a slide that shows that, so I'll show that in just a minute. This is a pie chart showing the same thing for just 1 year that I showed on the bar chart. Let me get to this next one, and this will answer your question a little bit. This is by the service that it provides. So the largest slice, the dark green there, is instruction. That's classroom instruction. And anything we purchase for the classroom, anything that's used in the classroom, so the teacher's salary, the labor-related costs that go with the teacher, the books, the supplies, all of those things that serve that classroom are going to be that dark green. And then kind of as you go around, it's kind of the ones closer to the instruction are the things closer to the classroom. So the lime green there says instruction-related services. That would be things that are our curriculum, supervision of curriculum, curriculum development, and school admin. So our principals and our school site staffing would be in there, as well as all the things that make their office run, their computers, the paper they need for their copiers, their copy lease. You know, all of those things are going to be in that instruction-related services. Pupil services are going to be things like the social workers, the counselors, the nurse, all of those things that are pupil-related services. So when we talk about our pupil services department, many of the items in special ed fall in there as well. Some of the services that we provide to our special ed students are going to fall into that pupil service, because it's not in the classroom. It's extra, you know, services that we provide. But that is where our counselors, our social workers, that's a big bulk of what that is. So kind of as you go around, the general admin is a lot of things. It is the district admin, as well as all the things that serve and support the district, like purchasing, human resources, finance, all the staffing and all the needs to pay bills and pay our employees.
Technology
is also in there. The big bulk of what is in technology are the many licenses it takes and the services. For instance, all of our services that keep everything running, our Microsoft licenses, our PeopleSoft that we've talked about a couple of times this year because of some waiver of some fees. That kind of thing is in that general admin. So it is a broad category of all the things that can't easily be divided up into things like classroom and all that, but it serves all that.
So I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the slide before this, you had the certificated salaries were 49%, and then the classified salaries were 14%.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That one, mm-hmm. And then the benefits were 21%. The certificated. Did you put the admin and the counselors and everything? Where did you put them in this project?
The counselors fall in certificated salaries, as do social workers, as do the nurses,
principals.
Principals, yeah. Many of the certificated administrators fall in that.
And so the admin are the certificated.
The certificate administrators are there, and the classified administrators are in classified
salaries. Are there.
So we're at like 85% then.
Yes, and okay. Which is about what most districts are tracking. They're saying with the STIRS and PERS increases that districts are falling in the actual 85 to 90%, and 90%. We're at 84. Mm-hmm. So we're at, you know, mid to low end usually in what they're saying statewide.
So then when would we go into the 90%? What are you projecting that, like a year from now, 2 years from now? Because I saw the slide coming up on that.
I'm not sure where. Oftentimes it rises a little bit at adopted, but as the year goes on and we have some other expenses that add, it fluctuates a percentage or two. So mm-hmm. it's usually highest at adopted, but by the time we close the books, it's often closer to the, it used to be about the 82% mark, but with STIRS and PERS, it is staying at about the 84% mark. So we stay about the same because our expenses generally go up in total. Mm-hmm. And so that percentage growth, you know, is about the same as the overall percentage growth. So the percentage of salary stays about the same.
Okay. And no one, and that part-time is not included in that, or is included
it,
in that?
It is included
okay.
in that.
Thank you.
Yeah, the both of this slide as well as the this one are defined by the state. They're mm-hmm. part of how the state tells us how we report everything. And so we, you know, any salary that's considered certificated, whether it's certificated or certificated management, falls in one category, you know, right. So it and that's why we often will show this both ways mm-hmm. because it kind of gives a better sense of not everything in certificated is actually in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And this kind of gives a little bit different view of it that helps.
Helps
know where we spend the dollar. Did want to also point out that plant services, that is a pretty good chunk up there in the darker orange. That is things like our maintenance, our custodial, and our utilities. So that's where you see that. And oftentimes it kind of sticks out because it seems big and we say, what are plant services? It's all of those things that are serving not just all our classrooms, but all of our buildings. So the maintenance, operations, grounds, all of that falls in there. So this slide is the CalSTRS rate and what it will be doing over time. And it, as you know, it is continuing to rise. It caps out at that 2021 rate, I believe, as I guess. It'll stay at that 19.1 until they have a new actuarial study, potentially, until they do some major things to raise rates. It took them a long time to raise the rates from 8.25. That was a big deal, so I kind of think that one will stay there for a little while. But of our, in 17-18, of our certificated employees, we pay about $1.3 million just in the increase in CalSTRS for 17-18. So it is a big cost for all districts. And then when you add CalPERS on it, the first bullet point has a 17.7 rate has been updated. The table at the bottom is what is correct. And that is not estimated, currently has been determined will be 18.062 for CalPERS in 18-19. So as you can see, those continue to grow. For 17-18, the increase alone in CalPERS was an increase to the general fund of about $500,000. So those two combined were $1.8 million. When the rates first started going up, you may remember we came in and said it was $800,000 to $900,000 increase. That started several years ago. That's how much it's grown. So it you know, as they multiply on each other, it just continues to grow.
And the difference, as we pointed out in the past, at CalSTRS, their rates are set by statute, so it takes a legislative act to change those rates, and that's part of the reason why they stayed the same for so many years. So that one's predictable because we know what it's going to be through, what was it, 2021?
Correct.
With CalPERS, they adjust it every year, and they're always doing a rolling outlook of what their liabilities are, and so everything is projected at that point. It might be higher, it might be lower.
When we brought First Interim, it was estimated to be that 17.7 in 18-19. That's why that didn't quite get updated. And in December or early January, they changed that estimate to 18.062. So they are changing that. This one will not cap out as far as currently with our current estimates that we can see. Things that may change that are any improvements to their actuarial reports. So when they look at their actuarial reports, they are revisiting, as Mr. Dill said, they're revisiting these each year and looking at, you know, what do we need to meet our current actuarial predictions. So kind of gives you an idea there. So in set to wrap those up together in 17-18, our budget increased by $1.8 million just in the STIRS and PERS increases alone. So the ending balance is something, I think I skipped a slide. Ending balance history is something you have seen before. We have added an out year on that you did not see it first at second interim. And that one is kind of in flux. The blue line, just to kind of give you an idea, the green line that you can see as each year finalizes, that tells you what the California average high school district has in their reserves. And this is kind of what's happening to our reserves in our current multi-year. So this is a picture of our second interim projection. You've seen this already. It is not any different than what you saw at second interim. And I just kind of give you an idea of how that looks and remind us of where we are.
Do we know at all, and when you had the bar graph that showed the average California school district, is there enough shared to know what theirs look like moving forward also?
It's no, because they wait until the years are complete. Then they take the cumulative
reporting
data for all of California, divide it by high school, unified, and elementary districts, and get an average.
Okay.
So that average is currently at about 15%. And that has fluctuated, as you can see, during the recession and the growth after the recession. It fluctuated here and there with LCFF. You know, it really does move quite a bit. It's leveling out, so it's staying kind of about that same. But it's hard to estimate because they don't know what every district's going to do, and they don't do it with interims or that kind of reporting. It's just... It's just too big of a moving target for them.
Thank you. Thank you for backing up a little bit.
Oh, yeah. The assumptions, I just kind of wanted to remind you, these are the same assumptions that we brought at second interim. The some basic assumptions, the 5% property tax increase, our estimated ADA. We remove carryover as we look at multi-year, because we don't know what that is till we close the books. The removal of that should be one-time revenue. We remove the one-time state revenue until we determine what if any, we will be receiving in one-time revenue. Step and column increases. Any estimated retirement savings, I can say those are based on average retirement age. Teacher is most of it, although we do have some classified in that figure. The kind of the average higher end teacher and the average lower end or mid teacher, and we just kind of take this many retirements, and this many replacements, replacing all of them. And I will say that at this point we are at, we may have actually had a couple more than what we had built in at second interim. So we're, you know, we do watch that. We have very conservative estimates in there based on prior years that we generally hit or surpass.
So we're usually, it's like on a cycle. Are we on a cycle right now where there's a lot of retirements and there won't be for a while?
It's slowing down.
Slowing down.
Yeah. When we get actuarial studies, they look at age, and it's staying about the same for probably the next couple of years, but that age bar is moving a little bit as we do actuarial studies. So, but we can generally count on somewhere we had 10 built in or 9 built in at second interim. We can generally gauge on about 10, and that has been true the last several years. I think about the entire time I've been here, which is 8 years, going on 9. We have been tracking it about that, and we've either hit it or exceeded it in each year. So that is a really conservative estimate for us.
Except and last then, year when it was 20.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Last year was quite a bit higher, and it didn't have a huge effect on this year, actually. It kept this year. We built in those estimates and thought, okay, they were conservative, and we have, we're right at them or slightly exceeded them at this point. So.
Okay, so I'm being told, a little birdie's whispering behind my ear, that so far this year we've had 17 certificated retirements. So.
Okay,
so now for the fun stuff. So what you're going to see in the next couple of slides are basically just some cost estimates of things that we've heard throughout the course of the last several months in terms of what the board may be looking for. And so we're going to share with you some of those cost estimates. And the hope is by the time the evening is done, that we're able to have a framework of what we need in order to finish the completion of the building of our budget for that first draft at that first week in June. As Ms. Gum had pointed out in terms of the gap, obviously what we have been trying to do is trying not to have large jumps in our expenses, because at this point what we are trying to do is kind of right size and flatline if we can. And so as we've had some retirees, we take a look at all of that to see whether or not those are positions that we need to fill and things of that nature. Whenever a position becomes vacant, we're looking at, do we need to fill it in that manner? Mark just told me today he saved us $40,000. He was able to negotiate with the contractor, a vendor for some services, and was able to get their increase down by $50,000. So we're looking at all of that stuff now. We continue to do that, and I think we will be continuing to do that going forward. Many of our people that we do business with are always looking at increasing costs, and we do negotiations with each of those to make sure that we can keep those costs down or those increases down to a minimum. We also obviously have the competing increased costs of just the natural part of doing business that we don't have a lot of control over, like the stirs and purse that we've talked about, utilities that we've talked about. And so what we're going to share with you are some of those cost estimates, keeping in mind that we're trying to make sure that we're flatlining as much as possible in terms of expenses. But then the hope is after we leave here tonight, we'll be able to go back based on the feedback that you're giving us and finish drafting a budget with the information that we're getting from the governor's May revise tomorrow as well, and then incorporate what we can into that first draft of the budget. I think for the first slide, I'm going to have Mark come up and kind of talk about what we're doing around this area. Mark, do you want to come up and talk about that?
All right. So as we look at social-emotional learning, one of the slides that step back talked about LCAP. And so LCAP goal number 4 looks at student connectedness, student wellness, and looking at that social-emotional learning component. And so identified within LCAP goal number 4 was that budget, which is primarily used for school social workers. And so school social workers are new as of last year, and they're beginning or they're ending their second year with us. And so to support social emotional learning, we basically have three groups. We have school counselors, we have school psychologists, and we have school social workers. Given that school social workers are new, beginning this fall or beginning last fall, we have been pulling together groups of, we have been pulling together the various groups to really start to align our work around social emotional learning and to truly understand what each group is doing along the various tiers. Because when you look at a clear multi-tier system of support, you start at the base. You start at the base of a triangle. At the base of the triangle is really what all students get and what all students have access to. And that's typically done by school counselors. When you look at the middle, that's really what a few more students are getting. Those are more intense services, and that's currently work being done by our school social workers. And then when you get at the very top of the pyramid, that's typically work that's really intensive around mental health and usually a student that has been identified for an IEP, and that is being done with our school psychologist. And so with the addition of our social workers and looking at needs of our students based on data, attendance, suspensions, expulsions, and our Healthy Kids Survey data, we're pulling all that together and say, what are we currently offering, and then how does that fall along the continuum? From that, where does it fall on the continuum? What we're trying to sort out is who's doing the work where, and where are some of those pressure points in terms of do we need to add additional staff, whether it be a counselor or whether it be a social worker? And so we are continuing to do that work, and we are looking to begin drafting a comprehensive scope and sequence for social-emotional learning, and we're hoping to have that work done by the fall. So as you look here, as you look at our counselor ratios, this is where they line out. We are below the state ratio at the high school level, and we are below the national ratio total. If you look at the National School Counselor Association, just in full transparency, I think that number is around 275-1.
220.
Yeah, it's about 220. I mean, you're not going to find a school district in the United States that's anywhere near that number. We are doing very well at the 477-1. When you look at school counselors, we're also looking at academic, college and career, as well as that social-emotional learning support. So pulling this group of experts together will truly tell us and identify if there are some pressure points, and to where we need to fill those gaps along our system.
This seems like too many. I mean, too many students for each counselor. I mean, even though you say that, 220, because I did call NAC about this, and they said that's really actually 220 is over the top, and because I talked to them at length about this.
Yeah.
And they said it should be a lot closer down.
What did you call? NACAC, National Association of School Counselors. They're the representative group that would represent the school counselors in terms of advocating for their needs.
The countrywide association.
Yeah. It's a national organization that advocates on behalf of school counselors. So they've set their needs at what they've identified is about 270-1. And looking at comparable districts, our state ratio, our ratio at the high school level is relatively low compared to other surrounding districts.
I actually had just, some of you might have also gotten the California Schools, and I was reading it when I was out of town a week or two ago, and it actually even says for California, even a higher ratio than the 477.
It's gradually increasing.
Not that that's what we want to be, we're doing better than...
And the primary reason for that is as districts have looked at their budgets and have had to reduce, there are several districts throughout the state that have gone to guidance techs and have eliminated counseling positions, and as a result, those counselors are now out of the ratio. So what they do in those districts is that they typically will have one counselor per high school, and then they'll hire guidance techs to really do the college and career work.
Thank you.
Yeah. I know at some of the high schools we've had kind of college and career support. I don't know if what exists now at the schools besides the counselors doing that.
Yeah. So
support system.
Yeah. So all of our counselors are hired under what's called a PPS credential, Pupil Personnel Services credential. And so under the California State credential and under the ASCA model, which is the Association for School Counselors, it really looks at that three-pronged approach. It looks like it looks at the academic intervention, it looks at the college and career readiness, and then it looks at social-emotional learning component. So all of our counselors are trained, because they're hired under the PPS model, to serve all three. Now, based on the community in which they serve and based on the school community in which they're assigned, there may be various pressure points. We may see some schools that provide more because they are seeing more of a social emotional learning support need. That's where some of their energies are. We have some schools that we're seeing more of the academic component, where folks are asking for more of that college and career aspect. And to be fully transparent, we have counselors that are more comfortable doing various aspects. And so that's truly what we're trying to sort out along the continuum is, are there gaps in terms of what we need to provide, and what would that then look like? Is it additional social worker? Is it an additional counselor? But until you have clearly articulated that plan, I'd be hesitant to recommend adding one above the other until we've looked at the need.
Before, I'd like to ask you all to put our mics a little bit more facing, sure. As we've had enough that people want to be
so
able
we
to
don't belong to NACA. I think they just went to that this year. Did you just buy like a short membership, or is our school district? I didn't think it was for NACA, is it?
I believe our individual counselors,
right, but
are members of
have a full membership for that.
I don't know. They don't offer one, actually.
Yeah.
I think it's individual. It's like the American Association for Speech, Language,
because I called and they said they didn't have one, but we had never applied for one.
From what I could find out, and I've been talking with Duncan,
right,
there is no, like, institutional membership. It's individual memberships because the individuals have voting rights. So they vote on, their individual, whatever their individual
leaders,
desires are for whatever the advocacy is. But Duncan has called, and they did not offer a institutional type of membership.
Well, because I called and they said we never applied. They said we just went with a short term for our counselors to go, because it'd be good for us to learn so much at that conference.
You're talking about the conference, not an actual membership.
No, a membership for all the other things that they give. They're always up to date on college information.
I was told by Duncan
that they don't have one. He called them, and they did not have one.
So you're not recommending counselors, because I got to tell you something, it's an issue. I mean, this is just ratio. It's just not good for our kids.
What I'm recommending is that at any point that we consider adding, that we strategically align to meet a certain need. So if there's a certain need within college and career readiness, or if there's a certain need among social emotional learning, that we consider what are we asking to consider? Is it adding more social workers? I'll share with you, we have four currently, and they're super busy as well. They are driving across the district, supporting a variety of needs and issues, but also supporting our parents in terms of providing community resources.
I think the counselors, because they're supporting their classes, what they want to take, college, is that it's a lot. And all the kids need help. And, I mean, this ratio of what we've got for La Costa Canyon, the ratio is 460, I'm like 470 kids per counselor.
Yeah, it's way too high.
That's way too high.
I can only tell you that I get a tremendous amount of mail and calls requesting that we have more counselors. And maybe they just use that as a generic term, but probably in both categories. I would think that this district should be much more not concerned at all with the state ratio or the national ratio. I think we have such a high-achieving district, and we have taxpayers paying so tremendously high taxes. And if our property taxes are actually going up 5% or the value is going up 5% a year, I think we should reflect that and give them what they're really ultimately looking for. And it's much more services in this area, because virtually I've never yet met a parent yet who doesn't tell us that their child is going to, college, and or that they're having difficulty getting the right classes and counseling. So if the purpose of this meeting is to find out what board members want, I think we should really focus on that in both categories.
Yeah, and I know, because really the social workers has just been the 1 year, right? So last year this was
year two,
it.
Yeah.
It's year two, so I appreciate when we were able to expand there.
And you were saying we're doing an analysis to see where the needs are, or when would we find...
We've done is, we've pulled together a representative group of school psychologists, counselors, and social workers to articulate what are we doing along the tiered system of intervention. Because as we've added social workers, while they were hired for a particular scope, what we're finding is that they're being asked to do above and beyond that scope. And it's great, right? It's a great resource. But at the same time, you know, is that, are there other things that we would like them to do as well? And if so, how would we then address that?
So we survey their parents, because I'm going to tell you something. You survey any parent in this district, they're going to tell you, we want more counselors.
Yeah, we do every year, and it's through our LCAP.
And through the LCAP, and I mean, LCAP, I think you put that out, and the parents are like, oh, you know, I don't have time, or that, or whatever, is that, I got to tell you something, I think it's unacceptable.
So, you know, one of the things that this analysis is doing, and you know, to kind of restate what Mr. Miller is saying, if we look at counselors and social workers together and they're both overlapping in their duties, if the reason why we're not able to provide the best service we can with counselors with, you know, college and career readiness and class selection is because they're spending a lot of time on social emotional support, then maybe it's we need to add more social emotional support so that frees up the traditional counselors to do that other work, and it puts that other, you know, and it
for
and
guidance,
it, yeah,
just
it frees
social
that
emotional.
Up.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, but if it's but if they're not if they're not wasting their time or not wasting, but if they're not if they're not consuming their time with the social emotional, it's just way too much work on the guidance piece of it. Then yeah, then the solution would be add more guidance counselors. So that's,
how can we do that? How can we put more counselors on the budget?
So again, this is what, you know, Mr. Miller is talking about, is we're looking at, you know, what is the workload of our school site counselors and social workers. So are we balanced the right way between those two job classifications? So where's the right place to add in order to support? Because what I'm hearing, of course, is that we need more work on the college and career readiness and on the guidance counseling piece of that. So is it we just add more of those folks, or if because they're spending a lot of time on the social emotional piece, we add that and it frees up time for them to be able to do that, then we've accomplished that goal. So one way or the other, we're trying to accomplish that goal.
The thing is, are you going to have this done by the June board meeting? Because we should have this for the next year. As if we're talking about the budget, this is where we should spend our dollars.
Mm-hmm. So I see on the next slide, or here it is, $140,000 would be per one new counselor at each site. Is that the cost? Is that the cost of?
It's the cost of a counselor as well as the cost of a social worker. They cost the same.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in terms of for budgeting purposes, we could budget. Mm-hmm. 140, if you will, and give the flexibility of whatever position it is that.
So it's 140,000 to start.
With their benefits.
Yeah. So this is total compensation.
Correct.
That counselors tend to be higher up on the schedule. Plus, they work a longer work year, so their salaries tend to be higher than the teacher salaries. So this is higher than adding additional teachers.
Okay,
so in doing the math, you know, one at each high school would be $560,000.
And so
the other piece I want to reiterate is, so when we look at school psychologists, sometimes that's a little different because we have service minutes from IEPs that we inherit from our feeder districts, and sometimes that would dictate adding additional psychologists. That's not along the continuum, but if we inherit students from a district that has intense social-emotional supports that would require intense mental health, then we may need to add based on what those service minutes per the IEP is. Sometimes we don't know that until June, July, when we look at our final students coming to us.
Yeah, okay. So, Mrs. D'Alessandro, you looked like you had something to say.
A while ago. I'm wondering if there has been an analysis done on our current counselors and their levels of expertise or their areas of expertise. And if, indeed, by removing the college counseling piece from them and having them deal with the kids in classes and their, you know, daily issues, if that wouldn't... But again, only if the counselors, for the most part, are weaker in the area or feel they have less time in the area of college counseling. We don't know that yet.
We don't.
We know that, then hiring specifically a college counselor on every campus would make a big difference.
Yeah, and so where it gets tricky, Joyce, is that all of our counselors are hired under PPS credentials, they're all qualified and trained to do the three areas. However, We know that some have a particular interest in providing social-emotional counseling.
Right.
Some have, I mean, so that's just their general interest. And some of them don't sometimes feel comfortable, and that's just more of a training component. And some are clearly, are gung-ho on college and career readiness, to your point.
Right.
So it's finding out that balance.
Right. I think every parent in this district expects someone who is gung-ho on college. Every parent expects that.
Well, then that would be a different need beyond a PPS.
But I mean, a counselor, they expect their counselors to know everything, and I think the counselors do. To say that some counselors don't, I disagree. They've been here a long time. They know that the kids are high performing. We had college night. These kids are high performing.
Right, and I think more the question is, would we consider restructuring so we have a designated college and career counseling person on each campus to help with that? But what I'm hearing is that all of our counselors are of course, credentialed to cover all of those areas. So I don't know if that's a possibility.
And that may come out.
Not all of them are as comfortable.
Right.
Right.
So I guess we're just trying to...
We don't know which campus has what sort of...
And to figure out how we add... Because I agree. I mean, I think all of us hear from the community all the time about the need for extra counseling support or social-emotional support. And if this is an area that we could invest in and really make a difference for all the students, then I would be in support of that. But I'm just not hearing exactly how that would be structured.
And that's the work that we're trying to do. It's because, one of the things we did was we hired the social workers and we wanted to let them work. We wanted to get them in and do the work. And now that they've done the work for a year and a half, it's like, okay, let's take a step back and let's look at the work you're doing. Let's look at the work everyone's doing. And seeing what is the best way to structure that so that we are meeting all the needs.
So are you going to be able to know? I think we need another counselor minimum at every school. I mean, if not two, more.
If you go back a slide, the allocation of counselors are based on enrollment. And so, looking at this, generally speaking, that ratio, at the high school level, is trying to keep around 470.
That's unacceptable in this district.
I'm just saying,
you have to add the other four social workers in on that, to get that number down at the bottom, because they're doing that similar type of work and supporting the social emotional needs.
Mm-hmm.
So, if we say, we want one more of each, well, is that
high school
counselor?
Is it? What's the blend of counselors versus social workers to meet all of those needs?
I don't think a lot of people, I don't use a social worker. Mm-hmm. I think the average person doesn't. They go in. But I think the college counselors, this district, I think you're crazy if you don't think the parents expect it.
I've also known that the counselors
are so important, and at minimum, one if not two more to each site.
Yeah, and I would also argue that social emotional learning is equally as important.
Absolutely,
and making sure that we cover that area as well.
And there's been all this talk also about wellness.
Correct.
Absolutely.
But if you think we need more, then you're right. Then we should have more than.
Yeah, it should be either or.
So that's what
we're talking about. We recognize that we do need more of both, and so what's the blend of each type?
Well, and there were a lot of other things on the list.
Mm-hmm.
As we go further, are we going to want some of everything?
We can't afford. Eric says that we're close the gap and we're fine. I asked for me, he said it's fine. So
we got lots of money,
he tells me.
Well, what I'll also say is we can do anything we want. We might not be able to do everything we want.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll come down to priorities and, how if we say 10 more, if you say one more at each, that's 10 more people, that's $1.4 million. So, and that's ongoing. And then we're going to have to see where do we offset $1.4 million elsewhere in the budget to at least stay at equilibrium. Otherwise, we're widening the gap between revenue and expenditures.
Well, I would love to add two more. I don't think we fiscally would be responsible jumping in and doing that without the analysis, but I definitely want to see more support in this area. So, but I
We're hearing that loud and clear.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Just want to make sure, but not saying
do two for
I'm not saying we're doing two.
Showing look at some of the other
priorities. This is now the work that
next slides.
And we'll take this information and incorporate it into that draft of the budget when we come forward on June 2nd. That's the whole purpose of the conversation this evening.
So we've got 20 more minutes for 7 more slides.
Okay, I'll try it. Well, it's important. So the one thing I wanted to add here, I listed it as an option, but the reality is it's not an option, but I wanted to make sure that the board was aware. The special education added authorization reimbursement, there is a new requirement that was passed, and I'm afraid I may not say it correctly, so one of these guys may have to jump in and help me. And so our special ed teachers have this authorization that they are now required to have. It is incorporated in their future certification, if you will. But for those that are already teaching, there is this new requirement that they're going to have to get. And so the district will be paying for our teachers to get that added authorization. And that's about $21,000 what we're projecting. So we will be including that in the budget for the 18-19
year. So all the requirements will have it.
Correct.
Not necessarily. It depends on when they get their credential.
Right.
So these added authorizations have to do with specific needs in the area of special education. So the vast majority of our staff, with the exception of maybe one, have already received the autism authorization, which was paid for last year.
Uh-huh.
Going forward, depending on the primary handicapping condition of students in their class, we've identified those that need to go back and get other authorizations.
But at this point, we've already won. They'll have this.
So the people coming out of the programs now,
right,
new, will have it.
We'll have it.
But
okay.
Existing employees that we might hire from other districts may or may not.
Okay.
And is this $21,000 for the year? Or
yes. No. That's based on what
for
we know right now in terms of our
staff.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And it's to our benefit because then it makes it easier to assign students to special education classrooms, knowing that those teachers can handle any of the conditions.
How long does it take to get the certification?
The authorization?
Uh-huh.
That's usually it's an online along with some coaching, so it takes about a year.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
So some safety budget options. So as you are all aware, we are already currently working on some safety initiatives right now.
Mm-hmm.
We have some money to the tune of about $1.4 million that we've identified that we're already currently using in terms of the perimeter security of our buildings. We have already brought forward the approval of a contract for surveillance cameras. For Torrey Pines, we are bringing forward this evening an agreement for the Raptor identification system. So we already have things that we've budgeted for that are in place that we will be putting in place or implementing at the start of the school year. Some of the other things that we've heard is the addition of some school resource officers and potentially some campus supervisors to increase security presence on our campuses. And so the information on school resource officers varies from agency to agency. And so $240,000 was information that we received based on VISTA.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a wide range. So because of the wide range and not knowing what locations, we picked one that was a little more on the higher end.
Explain to us what they do. What would somebody do for $240,000 a year?
Well, typically you would have an SRO at a high school, and in essence, they're at the high school, walking around, communicating with the students.
So, like a security guard is $240,000.
No, it's a police officer.
These are police officers.
It's a law enforcement agency, as opposed to a campus security who is not part of law enforcement.
That's what they reimburse.
Oh, it's from the police. Oh,
yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, well, I don't think we would. I wouldn't go that route.
Right.
That's outrageously expensive.
So that's the difference between an SRO and campus and a campus supervisor. Mm-hmm. Is there an SRO is actually someone from a law enforcement agency.
Mm-hmm.
That
it.
We then would reimburse the agency for the cost. And then a campus supervisor is one of our own employees, hence the difference in the cost.
Yeah.
That would pretty much be doing the same type of work.
I know. As the city of Encinitas said that they would pay half, and they said it was $120. They already looked into it. And so I know that Kasia said last night at the board meeting that you'd already said that we didn't want it. She said when you guys met at the liaison meeting, she was talking about it at the board meeting last night. And so the city of Encinitas already said that they would do that, and I think it was a 1 point they checked into it.
Yeah, we spoke about continuing to have the conversation about that and whether the city would be willing to cover part of the cost.
Right.
And it didn't end with that. It didn't say us not wanting it. Yeah. You know, we talked about the pros and cons of that, and as we talked about a few months ago when we had a discussion in this room and invited the agencies here, that... One, I think we're getting great service from the Sheriff's Department and in the city of Encinitas, and I think we're getting better service with SDPD than we've ever had, and we've always had great service with Carlsbad. So, you know, right now, baseline, they're responding to us, and they're covering many of our needs. You know, in the aftermath of Florida, there's been, you know, a lot of urging from folks to add SROs, and, you know, that was something that following Columbine, you saw SROs proliferate all across the country. And, you know, when we, both the cities and school districts, reduced that during the recession, they reprioritized the funding. You know, I would say City of San Diego, they came to us at over $300,000, and that was back around 2008 or 2009,
because you know,
for one officer.
Paying the officers.
Yeah.
Salary you are paying for the
pension,
equipment that he uses,
the car,
even bullets were included on the
My recollection was it also generally wasn't just one officer to cover all the week. They often needed to have some other partial. So it's more than one single.
And those are some of the other challenges. Is some of them work 5 day work weeks. Some of them work four tens, and so we would have days where we wouldn't have anybody. So there's challenges there, but, you know, we're throwing, since this is the budget discussion, we're throwing the budget amount on here.
And keep in mind it's going to be different depending on the agency. So if there is a want or a need for us to look into school resource officers, what school sites would that be? Then we'd have to reach out to the agency, find out what that cost would be, if they even have the staffing to be able to provide it. At one of our safety updates, I think it was SDPD that said we don't even have the staff to provide.
Right.
So those would be all the things that we would look at if this is where, you know, the board chooses us to kind of dig into and see if that's something that wants to be added to the budget.
The only thing I'm worried about is that's what he said, that he's covering four districts and it would take 40 minutes if there was an emergency. That's what he said at the meeting. That now we wait and if something happens and it's like... I would hate something to happen and here we're having a discussion about money because our kids' safety is priceless.
I'll say that he's a sergeant that covers multiple stations of the juvenile services team, so he was thinking from a bigger perspective than just our neighborhood in Carmel Valley and Pacific Highlands Ranch. We have the same officers that we see every day on our campuses, and they are out of the Northwestern station. So they are local to our station, but he was thinking of also San Diego Unified areas that he's also in some Poway areas that he's also covering. So he was thinking a little bit bigger than just our neighborhood.
Okay.
Yeah.
So are we paying those SROs that are on the Torrey Pines campus?
No.
We're not.
Correct.
I didn't think we were. So why would we hire somebody?
Well, that's been part of my point is that, again, I think we're getting great service from all three agencies. You know, we see them every day. They're consistently working with us. They've, you know, shared their contact information, including their cell phone numbers, with our administrators in case they need them faster than going through a dispatch. You know, we can pick up the phone and call them. So it's very much like when we had SROs, only we're not paying the freight for that. And the nice part about it, as I mentioned a few months ago, is when we had SROs, particularly in the city of Encinitas, any juvenile-type call the station was assigning to the SROs, whether it was on our campus or not. And so those two SROs would get bogged down with every juvenile call in the area, and so they often were not available to go to other campuses when they were needed. And they would often keep them... if they arrested a student, they would make them go to the station and wait there until the parents showed up. And so they weren't available to be on campus until mom and dad got off of work and showed up to pick up the student. So there were a lot of drawbacks that we had there, and that's why under this current model, when there's a deputy available, we get a deputy. And so it's beyond just the assigned SRO. So those are some of the things that I think are benefits to the model that we have now.
I think just, you know, school resource officer in that term is just unnecessary. I think what mainly the parents that I have been talking to and that I've received is that they want just more campus security. When I worked as a teacher in Escondido High School had like 4 to 5 security guys in golf carts. I don't think we even need that many, but I think at Torrey Pines, we had one. Maybe we have two now, but I certainly think that at Torrey Pines, CCA, we should have at least 2 or 3 so that they can be spread out in communication. I don't think they need to be licensed police officers. I think they just need to be somebody with eyes and a radio who can communicate, and if they need to call the cops, they can call the cops. So I think that's what people are really asking.
How many do we have now?
So great question. Day. I was going to just answer that for Mr. Salazar. So at our high schools, we do have 2 per school, and we've got 1 per middle school right now.
So 1 on campus every day?
Correct, mm-hmm. correct. Okay. So there are classified employees, and they're there during school hours. Mm-hmm. And we actually increased their hours this year so that we would have more coverage, you know, for the full school day.
And we are also going to be providing some training to all the campus supervisors as well this year. So it's a 24-hour training over a 3-day period. So we'll be doing that too, in addition, that we've already anticipated including in the budget for next year, which is why it's not here, because we've already anticipated including that. They've asked for that.
So we call the police department. They know it's us. Mm-hmm. It's our number designated. No, they're doing something in Poway, which is different. Where they actually have a line and they know it's coming from the high school district if it's an emergency.
Not only do they know it's us, we have a smartphone system, and so mm-hmm. if somebody called from a classroom, it would show up in the dispatch center that they're in, you know, room 22 at this campus, mm-hmm. or room 201. Mm-hmm. So it drills down all the way to the dispatch, so you know, we made that upgrade with Prop AA. So we have 9
we
more minutes.
I think I've heard where we kind of want to go with this slide. Okay, so some site support budget options, and so here are some of the things that we have also heard, and I know that there was a parent here today, I think she's gone now, that talked about a theater technician. Mm-hmm. So the CIF calendar is changing, and so with that change, there could potentially need to be a shift in terms of support at the school sites, because we don't start until after the CIF calendar begins. And so there is a need there to have some extended time, if you will, for athletic directors and the CIF secretaries that support that because of that calendar shift. So that's a consideration. There's also been some conversations around reducing the student ratio in the classrooms by 1. And so if we were to decrease the student ratios by 1, then that would, right now with our current projection for enrollment, that would mean an increase of 11 teachers, and it would be a cost of about $1.4 million. So just to kind of put some context behind how many levels do you want to reduce the ratio by, we could do the math. But and then the other piece that you see up there is a theater technician, and that a parent came and spoke about that today. So those are some of the other conversations that we've heard. Want to get some input on what that might look like, and you know,
And I'll say I don't believe Torrey Pines has one.
They don't.
And actually, LCC has had one.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that person has resigned.
But they had it for that production.
So what I'll say is, as we're building the Performing Arts Center at Torrey Pines, right. it very well may be that it would be time to bring on one at Torrey Pines as well.
Sure. Let's get both. That'd be great.
Well, I think we have had the positions. I think some of the energy was around, are they classified in the accurate place for the work they're doing? So it sounds like work's being done on that.
Yeah. So we've got one at CCA?
Yeah, I think that's our only one one's working the most hours. I think SDA then would fall in behind that one, and then LCC was less than that. And really has to do with the number of productions that they have. Right. And mm-hmm. CCA seems to always be in production for something.
All kids deserve the best, and the theater program is thriving there.
It certainly is. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what are we talking about, two here? Because I wanted R3.
Well, I would say at minimum it would be one, and then when the Torrey Pines Pacific Performing Arts Center is finished, which would be the following school year, that we would be looking at adding that one in the future.
Funding the one at La Costa Canyon.
Yeah, that's what that would cost there, and so we can add that in and show what that would that would look like.
And I don't understand, it says decreased teacher ratio, you're saying decreased teacher by one kid per class.
Yeah,
class.
So
42 to be 41.
Okay, so then.
Correct, yes,
yep.
Absolutely.
And so with every one that we would reduce, if it was the desire to bring it down, we would just multiply it by that. So if you say lower by 10, well, that would be $13 million, almost $14 million that we would have to
very
add. the problem with that is we would have to cut teachers only to add teachers back. Since that's where the bulk of our staff is. So, without a funding source for that money, it would be challenging to do that. But we are talking with
our budget to be able to sustain a positive certification with that either.
What I would say is, we're talking with our...
We maybe should have thought about that before the 12.5% increase.
So we're talking with our Teachers Association now. I can't negotiate in open session here, but that's part of the topic of negotiations.
Lowering class size is always a priority.
Yeah, I get a lot of emails on lowering class sizes.
This has been an issue for as long as I can remember.
But it doesn't seem like anybody has cared until
we resolved it. We need to resolve the issue.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Well, okay, do it here. We can hire more teachers.
Many, many discussions about it. And it is, first of all, you're seeing an average, and PE classes are very large. When you talk about the AP classes, AP teachers have been in this boardroom actually telling us that they prefer larger classes. It gives much more platform for discussion and interaction of ideas, and they actually seek larger classes.
In the 7 years I've been here, I've never heard an AP teacher say that.
Having had a student recently in high school, she felt that
the class sizes were too large.
Oh my gosh.
I think we need to
I have not even yet heard a discussion about class sizes. This is the first time in 8 years.
Well,
with the exception of a few years ago when we were discussing the raises, and we were told class sizes aren't going to go up.
And they haven't changed the average maximum, they changed the word.
Can we one more time have the clarification on that? Because that's been misinterpreted many times.
Yes.
And I know that it's been
so
what's that?
The language in the old contract versus the current one. The old contract was pupil teacher ratio, the current one is class size. Those are not the same thing. And so in the old contract, you had to do a few more steps in the math to get to the average class size. And when we did that, we would get the number that we have in the contract now. And it was seen as a cleanup to say, instead of talking pupil-teacher ratio, let's talk about class size. And so we finished the other side of that equation and put that in. It was always we always had the same end result when we had the old language versus the new. Because, again, we were talking about two separate things. So there was no change in the average class size between contracts.
Well, they went up. Another thing is, I'd say that's not true. Oh, I think it is. Okay, let's go.
Okay, we really only have the last couple of slides we really don't need to go through. This slide is probably the last one, if you will. So we've talked about transportation. Back in February, I think we had kind of a study session. At that time, we had talked about sending out a survey to our parents. Also during that same time frame, we had some issues with contractors for our field trips, and so we weren't able to get a lot of, we had to cancel, if you will, and parents had to figure out a way to get their kids to school, the field trips, because we didn't have enough contractors to provide that service. With that being said, we did not send out a survey because the concern was we didn't want people to feel like we were being reactive to what was happening with everything else in transportation. And so our plan is to send out a survey in October and survey what parents are feeling in the sense of transportation. What you see up here is a savings, if you will, of routes to the tune of about $150,000, and what that would mean would be the potential of eliminating the least efficient routes within the district. And what you see in the yellow highlights are those routes that are the least efficient, if you will. They serve the least amount of students. I think the total there is about 160-something. It's on my actual slide. So that is kind of what we were hoping to do, is to get a flavor for the board. Is the board willing to have us take a look at the reduction of bus transportation in the sake of efficiency? If you'll see here, the first Oak Crest one is only serving 20 students. We've got 2 students in the morning, 18 students in the afternoon. So if we are able to eliminate some of those in terms of efficiency and then have some surveys and conversations, yes.
So where's that route to? Where's that route
from?
I'm not even going to state that. I don't know where the pickup is.
We'll have to.
That'd be good to know if you're talking about cutting anything, where these kids are coming from, where they're going to.
Oh, and is there a possibility to collapse any of the routes into each other?
Right now, if you look at the other ones are pretty full in the sense that the bus load is about 50. Mm-hmm. Right now we have some school sites where we're dropping off kids an hour before school starts, and then they're waiting until an hour after school starts. We consolidate as much as we can. We have very little room to consolidate some of the routes.
So how would it be communicated to the families that would be affected, because if that happened?
Right. So obviously we would start up a communication plan right away so that we can get information out to parents. Haven't talked about whether or not that would be us going out to school sites or having forums, communication, if you will, in terms of districts sending out information to parents, letting them come in and speak if they want. But at the end of the day, I think most parents are going to say, keep it, we need it. I don't think you're going to get a parent that is going to say, don't keep it.
We would need to let them know.
Oh, absolutely. And we would absolutely.
And if there are other options, say if there's a bus stop not as far away that they could get their students to.
Right.
So, you know, some accommodation for that, especially the larger routes, because I'm looking at, you know, some of them still have the capacity of 45 students, et cetera. So.
Right, and that is total. You'll see that for that particular one, the morning is 34, and then the afternoon is only 11.
Mm-hmm.
So there is where some of the problem lies. It's hard to eliminate. I mean, I guess we can eliminate half, but then it doesn't actually provide us with the ability for one to be able to serve those field trips of which we don't have buses for, you know, and things of that nature. So
it'd be good to know why it dropped off. Is that where the route is and why it dropped off to such a degree? I mean, why did it drop? Did we ever ask the parents why it dropped off?
Yeah, well, I think it was when the bell schedules changed for the middle school was where a lot of the ridership decreased.
Oh, no, I meant the afternoon.
Yeah, it works both ways, because we only had so many buses, but the bell schedules got aligned. They used to be staggered, and so in order to maintain the same amount of service, half the schools would have an early pickup, and half the schools would have a later drop off, and so that's what caused the problem.
Is all these schools, the middle schools, both parents are working.
I think that's my concern, and what we've discussed year after year is especially some of the communities or neighborhoods where this is their way to get kids to school. So, again, being sensitive to that is us.
I don't think it's
why we've been reluctant to.
Right. And I think our biggest worry is at this point, it's not even a cost consideration in terms of saving. It's more of we're having a harder time filling those bus driver positions, and you guys have heard that. And so before it gets to the point where we don't have a bus driver to take one of those routes, our thought process is how do we kind of reduce some of those services so that we can, if you will, redeploy those bus drivers, and then we don't have that issue. We've had a vacancy on the books for, I don't even know how long the vacancy's been on the books.
All year.
We just can't get anybody to fill that position. So that is that one conversation. And then another piece of the conversation is we've had a lot of additional square footage. You guys know everything that we've done in terms of Prop AA, and during all the time of the construction, in the sense of what we've added in terms of a footprint, we haven't added any additional custodians. And so we're currently looking at how much square footage have we added at each school site. In some cases, we've swapped out 14 classrooms for 14 classrooms, and maybe there's not a need there. But in the instances where we've added an entirely new building, mm-hmm. is there some capacity to hire additional custodians as needed?
We definitely need more custodians. Yeah. The kids are doing a lot of that recycling, and I know Eric, I sent that out to him, and they shouldn't be doing that.
Okay. I hate to drag us, keep
us
short.
The rest is just highlights. There's nothing really there.
It's all in the packet.
Well, and I think you can continue to give feedback to our staff if you hear something.
I want to ask about is the pool facility for the LCC.
They'll be ongoing.
Yes.
So we're going to pay for that.
Yes, that's already been included.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And not just for LCC, but
it's
all schools.
For all of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yep.
Okay.
I'm at all closed. So sorry about that.
So you want to adjourn us and open us
just
and close us?
Saying.